I guess I could talk a bit about certain fun things that have happened to my programming style, I guess, during the course of Space Beast Terrifier development. I mean, early access development. I've been finding that some people know this. I've written a bit about this and talked a bit about this. But I've been finding that I'm really moving away from object-oriented programming, which is sort of funny because I was like when I was starting out in the games industry in the late 90s, I was really a super-duper fanboy of the whole idea of higher-level programming. Of course, I wanted to do games because, I mean, I was really, really affected by the original Doom, and that's what really got me into into being interested in game development in general. So, I mean, I wanted to do stuff that was like that was like real-time graphics and high-performance stuff. But when I started programming seriously, it was really C++ that was all the rage. It was like that was the idea of this is how you should be programming, and object orientation was a huge part of that. And being exposed to C++, you learn initially that this is something that was built on top of C, and C is procedural, and does not have the object-oriented things. And it seemed, being young and everything, but it seemed like it was just so obvious that yes, this is better. This is an evolution of programming. This is like where the state of the art is at. And I guess in a lot of ways, I've always had like maybe a little bit of too much trust in the authority figures in my life, I would have to admit. So I was thinking, okay, the people who know stuff about programming, they say that this is what you should do. So we'll do that. And I mean, to be honest, that's what the whole industry seems to have done since then. It's like object-oriented programming is, what are you gonna say? I mean, that's what we do. It's interesting to find basically 20 something years later, after been programming seriously all that time, how I'm really, really just full circle moving away from all of those things that make object-oriented programming, quote unquote, better or different than procedural programming. For interesting reasons, for reasons that are, that came not from any sort of dogmatic or philosophical place, but really from actual practical experience of working on game development, working on game development on like a tiny budget, and trying to get some features to work. That are, features that are motivated by, oh, I want the game to do this. What is the best way? What is the most efficient way to use my time? And, all of that stuff. Maintainability, of course, is a huge part of everything. I mean, there's some background to it. I've been working on my Normware code base, which is sort of been, the hobby code base outside of any serious job. I started to realize that, wow, I've been working on this in some way, shape, or form since really 1994 or something like that. So there's always been this aggregate thing on my hard drives of building and growing, and I guess all the indie development stuff sort of came out of that parallel to working at essentially mainly Massive Entertainment, which is Ubisoft Massive today. And of course, experience from DICE and some other places too. It was really, I think, let's see, let's get this right. Object-oriented all the way until maybe I started working at Dreamlur, which is a company. I worked there 2013 to 2015, something like that. But I quit that job to seriously work on Space Beast Terrifier full time. But that job was about it was close to game programming because the idea was to build a planning tool, a piece of planning software that required real-time graphics and like real-time networking and things like that. So they hired me based on my experience with real-time systems that way. And it was, you know, really a lot of custom graphics programming and network stuff. And what happened was I came into contact with two different styles of programmers there, which was a good challenge for me because I basically wrote the basis of the client code base for that company. And I was really still into serious object-oriented style, right? So that's what I based it all off what I usually did. And a guy came in and who was much younger than me and just out of university, and his style was very, very much modern C++ 11. And like, there's a lot of new C++ features that I hadn't really cared to become aware of, and there's a lot of Lambda stuff and things like that. And it was funny because I found that, wow, I really didn't like any of that stuff. I'd had some experience earlier with things like Boost and the whole philosophy behind things like Boost, which I interpret as, oh, we want C++ to both be super high performance and low level, but we also want it to have all the modern language features that you would find in something like Java or C# or something like that. We want it to be both low level and high level. And I'd found maybe perhaps that even though I was thinking that I was doing, you know, object-oriented programming, I guess I found during the years at Massive, and especially after Massive, that maybe Massive didn't really go all the way into all of that stuff as compared to some others who would do like lots of template metaprogramming and stuff like that and use Boost and all that. So I guess I was maybe a bit conservative to begin with. And when I met this guy at Dreamler, it was like, yes, I seem to be very conservative, you know? So I'm like, okay, I'm object-oriented, but I'm not super into the state of the art, I suppose you could say. And then another guy joined the company and did a lot of, and was another style of coder, really. He'd been doing a lot of procedural programming in PHP, and he wasn't really used to any form of object orientation. So he even felt that my stuff was way too object oriented. I mean, not to mention the younger guy coming on. It's like, oh, so there's this sort of interesting discussion started up with like, what is a good style? I mean, I guess I was maybe for the first time since leaving Massive and DICE, it's like, oh, now I'm talking to other coders about where should you be at, what's effective and what is efficient in small teams and all that stuff. And the procedural guy, I guess he really started affecting me a lot. And it's like, all of this stuff is sort of, a lot of the object-oriented stuff sort of feels like boilerplate. It's like, why do we need all this stuff? And what's the point of all of this, you know? So I guess during my time there, I sort of devolved further. I fell further away from wanting to do any sort of abstract programming, any sort of, you know, like polymorphic, crazy, super elegant, you know, high-level stuff, even more than before, right? So that was interesting. And I sort of found that stuff while working on Normware stuff on the side. I sort of found that stuff sort of infecting my own code base too, and that was interesting. But the real kicker, was working on Space Beast Terraform, right? Because then I quit Dreamler, I got to work by myself again, and I was working with artists, and I was the only programmer, and I was just so under the gun, because it's like, the interest for Space Beast Terraform happened sort of out of the blue. It was nothing I was really expecting. And I really felt that, oh, I gotta get on this. I gotta quit my day job. I have to work on Space Beast Terraform right now because it's happening now. And I really wanna, you know, I wanna roll with it now that people are interested. And so the whole push of getting it out into early access as soon as possible after the demo, which in some ways I suppose I felt that maybe I'd given too much away, perhaps. With the demo, I mean, it's great. It's great that there was interest for it, but the whole initial rush was, oh my God, I have to get some other feature in there, that would you know, make it so it's okay to charge money for it, right? And that was the first feature, of course, was co-op, like local co-op with Xbox controllers and stuff. So I was even more than before in a situation where you have to be effective, you have to be efficient, you can't spend time writing code that, you know, sort of doesn't do anything but looks nice. So the whole move into minimalism was sort of, to a further extent, just, it was reinforced by the state of things. And then by the time that Space Beast Terrify got to the point where there was network multiplayer, which was like a really important feature, of course, and we had it rolled out and tried it, of course, on a local network, and we tried it across Göteborg, the city where I live, and then we tried it across Sweden, and we were, you know, trying to break it, trying to see, does this architecture work? Is it something that we can ship? And the funny thing, it's like it's like such a first world problem. The internet infrastructure in Sweden is just so good. So the implementation, which was essentially like a LAN-style peer-to-peer architecture, the initial what I call Peer 1, it worked. It just totally worked for internet play in Sweden. And I was like, okay. Always, you know, with the interest of getting updates out there as often as possible, we shipped that. And it was like, I had no real expectation that it would work internationally. It was like, this is not, it's not tolerant to high latencies, because technically what I'd done just a little bit of input buffering, which introduces, you know, latency that you can feel as compared to single player, but it was like something like 60 milliseconds, 4 ticks or something like that. So beyond that, if you had latency higher than that, it would just simply block, and the simulation would stall, and it was just horrible. So, and of course, that was the feedback that we were getting in the forums back from people. It's like, oh yeah, it doesn't work. It's laggy. It's terrible, and we want it not to be, right? That was the challenge there. It was like people were saying, you know, I really want to play this internationally with my friends. Like I'm in Europe and they're in the States or something, and I want to play it. I'd rather play this than, in some instances, somebody said, I'd rather play this than play Counter-Strike Go. So please fix it. And I was like, I know that that's really hard with this architecture, but oh my God, it's just such a challenge, because if people would rather play this than Counter-Strike Go, then, you know, that's awesome. It's awesome that people care, right? And the feeling that this game sort of, the space that this game is sort of moving around in is sort of the same as these, you know, really high production value first person shooters. And I mean, that was just way too good to be true. So I was both, you know, consciously and unconsciously thinking about what can be done to solve the problem of making Space-Based Terrafright able to be played at higher latencies and, you know, the typical wild, big woolly wild internet situations. So how did I solve that? This is, of course, the next part here. While working on other things, and not sleeping much, I suppose, I sort of got this idea into my head of just, you know, naively looking at the problem. It's like, what is the thing that people do not appreciate about Peer 1? Like, what is the problem? The problem is that the simulation stalls. And the reason it does that is because there's just not enough time to run the game at 60 hertz and have all the inputs arrive for the given tick that you need to simulate, you know, in what is, you know, essentially 60 milliseconds. It's stupid, because, oh, I know what my current local player needs to do, because I'm generating that input locally and I have that input and I could tick for myself. But if I do tick for myself, then all of the inputs that I don't have from anyone else, they're missing. So if I tick, I'm just cheating. It's like, it's not the truth. Because the whole idea is, it's based on determinism, it's based on that everyone, it's like a chess game, I guess, in that's going really fast. to do remote, you know, simulation of that everyone needs to do on their own machine. It's like, what did you do for take zero? Oh, I did this, and I know what I did myself, and then I can do it one step, right? And then you keep doing that, and it just, it doesn't diverge because of determinism in the code base that we're running at you know, a fixed tick and all that stuff. I mean, that's a whole other issue if you don't understand how deterministic input-driven networking works. Of course, you need to go look at that. But anyway, it doesn't work at high latencies. It's just not possible to get the information sent between all the different machines for that to work. So what is the problem? The problem is the stalling. And it's funny because being a game developer for a long time, it's obvious that especially in network games, and I played a lot of Quake and stuff like that back in the day, it's like with the client server architecture, one of the things that sort of is seen as a plus, and again, Space Beast is not client server, but client server is sort of like what the Dooms and the Quakes evolved into, and id Software and John Carmack was really they were the pioneers of this, and you know, sort of figuring out that it needs to be client server, because I guess there are a lot of things there. It's like the server can be a beefy machine, the server can be on some network that has, you know, it's on a good network. And but mainly, I think what the layman or what the user sort of reacts to there is, oh, if I have a good connection, then the game will be good for me, and then I don't care about anybody else, right? I only care about my experience, and that's absolutely, that can't be faulted, because that's just, you know, human psychology, and that's how people play games, right? And again, it's that's reinforced by the fact that most, if not every single first-person shooter that's out there is a client-server architecture. I can't, of course, know that for sure, but it seems to be the trend. And definitely that was the case for Space Beast, that the feedback in the forums were, oh, it's peer-to-peer. Oh, that's the problem. That's why it's bad. And you need to switch to client-server, right? And that is, in a sense, you could say, yes, that's true, because we know since the 90s that you can't do peer-to-peer on anything other than a LAN. And of course I knew this, and it's like, I've done a lot of network programming. At Massive, I did a lot of network programming, and we always ran the ground control games on client-server, which was an interesting thing in and of itself, because that wasn't supposed to be possible with drop-in support and like moving lots of state across the network and everything. So I knew all about the trade-offs, and that was really... I mean, without even thinking about it, that was really why Space Beast was peer-to-peer to begin with, because it was all about, oh, we're in early access, we need to get it working, get the networking working quickly, because we want, you know, we want to sustain player interest in the game. We want things to move forward. So one of the nice things about peer-to-peer, given the fact that the game already was deterministic, is like, oh, this is a relatively small thing to add, and it's really separate from the whole code base. It's like, if you do it through deterministic input driven, like if that's your architecture, if you do that as a solution, everything that works in single player will automatically work in multiplayer, and that's really important, because it means there are less special cases, and you know, it's about economy. It's about a single programmer trying to do something that's really way too ambitious on no budget. So it's like, oh, I have to make those choices. And that's why really peer-to-peer was the shortest, you know, distance to some sort of networking feature, right? But now, of course, we're in the situation where, okay, peer-to-peer is there and it's solid, but it doesn't work because of latency. And like, how do you solve that? And it seems like you can't solve that, because it's like, just there's not enough time. When you need the inputs from everyone else, you need them now. You don't need them. You can't have them later, right? And that's what causes the blocking, and that's just basically the user experience problem. It's I don't want it to block, and I want to have a good... I'm speaking as a user now. I don't want it to block. I want to have a good experience, because I know that I'm on a good network, and I don't really care about everybody else. So looking at it as a, you know, from a sort of naive brute force way, it's like, okay, we can't block. It's like, if the game did not block, then everything is really good, because all the information required to do the simulation, aside from remote players' inputs, is really available. And because the network and the single player versions are really exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same simulation. The only problem is there are external things, which are the other players' inputs, that are, you know, they need to come across the wire. And being late, that's the problem, right? Because the whole idea is to do remote simulation that does not diverge, because otherwise people won't be playing the same game, right? And of course, you know, there's a lot of scariness involved in doing things around determinism. The game has, by this point, the game has replays. And it's always sort of icky when you're messing around with code base. You're like sort of scared. I'm always sort of scared. It's like, oh, is it possible to do things that will break determinism? And nobody's going to tell you that you break determinism. It's not like the code will crash or it won't compile or anything. It's just like it's really subtle and you won't see it. So I started messing around with things like, you know, doing... This is actually a little bit the cart before the horse. One of the ideas that's always there is how do you validate determinism, right? And up to this point, there was no such validation, no technical validation of you know, to answer the question, does the simulation diverge or does it not? We just went ahead with, it seems to not diverge. So that's what we shipped, right? But back to the question of how do you solve this without making the architecture more complicated, without having to give things up. I didn't want to give up the fact that the single player and the multiplayer just work. They're the same thing. I didn't want to move to client-server necessarily, because my sense of the thing was there's way too much state to move in client-server. And I mean, that needs to be talked about, because since my experience at Massive with the ground control games, the RTS games, those network architectures were sort of messy, because they were a mix of reliable and unreliable networking protocols. So we basically had, for each client to the server, we had a TCP connection up for the reliable things. I think we did stuff like you know, like map loading and all the state that really needs to arrive in order and not be dropped and all that stuff, and even player commands, things like that. We deemed to be, they need to be reliably delivered. We did that on TCP, and then all of the, you know, the incremental state flooding from the server back to the client was all UDP. So things like what are the positions of all the tanks and the infantry and all these things. And that was, we knew that stuff could be, the only thing that was interesting there is obviously the latest information. So packet, it was all designed around, you know, being robust for packet drops. We don't do resends, we don't care, it's just give me the latest state and I'll just apply that. And I mean, I'd always been really interested in network programming, but it was like, it always felt really icky, the whole, you know, the mix of the UDP and the TCP. And I mean, the explosion of all the sockets you need for that, and the whole thing that we obviously saw in the ground control games is like, if you had a command that says, oh, the server says create a new tank here, okay, and the client gets that and it's all good, right? And then the server starts spamming updates to the client. It's like, oh, here are the position updates for this thing. And then another reliable command comes later from the server that says, oh, this tank got destroyed, so remove this object, right? And then you're always going to get into a situation where a little bit later you get updates from the server that are, you know, out of order or draw or late or whatever, that say, oh, update that tank that is now destroyed. And so you had to, you know, on an application level, write things like, oh, ignore that, because we know that that's by design, right? Those things may arrive late or out of order, and you have to be robust to see, oh, we're trying to update something that's already been removed. So it's like philosophically really strange. It's a messy architecture. Also, can be noted that when I wrote the network abstractions for messaging, like how do you actually write things to the wire. I made sort of a wrong assumption there. It's like there was a concept of a message where you can write bytes, like different data types, into a byte buffer and then send it across the wire. But that was always viewed from application point of view as, oh, here's a message, right? It's like a cohesive thing. And when I send that across the wire, it's going to be delivered cohesively. And of course, you know that with TCP, it's reliable and you're going to get it. You're going to get it. It's going to arrive because that's the guarantee of TCP with resends or whatever. With UDP, it's like, oh, it could be dropped. It's funny because that's true. All those things are true, but UDP is a datagram protocol. So what it means is you either get, if you get something, you're going to get an entire datagram, right? And that's true up to the MTU size. So as long as you keep it small enough, your packet's going to, if it arrives, you're going to get the cohesive packet. The misunderstanding was really, if I do the same thing over TCP, I send some block, then I'm going to get that all in one go, which is not true, because TCP is a streaming protocol. So there's really no concept of packets there. There are packets, of course, technically under, but that's not what's exposed from the protocol. It's a stream. So you send 500 bytes, you may not get those 500 bytes in a cohesive single call to, you know, receive some stuff. And that really messed also with us until we realized that, oh, right, you have to take that into account. And if you're imposing some sort of application level structure or packet or message or whatever, you have to understand the differences between the protocols. And that was, you know, that was also a source of ickiness. That's not fun. That's not good. It's not smart. So in the years after Massive, you know, working on other stuff, not necessarily network stuff, I happened to read something about, I think it was Brian Hook did a write-up about what John Carmack had done on Quake 3. And it was sort of pitched as, oh, this is when we really got it right. And the whole idea of you can read about it in other places, but the Quake 3 idea is really really super simple from a protocol standpoint. It's like the client has an upstream packet, which is, of course, you put in an MTU. It's like key flags and view angles for a first-person shooter, and you stream that up. And it's like, in that case, the server's only interested in the the latest version, I guess, for the real-time stuff. There was some stuff in the article about, oh, how do you do stuff like chat messages, which are like supposed to be reliable. You do it brute force. You have a field in your whatever latest real-time input that is the chat string, and you keep spamming the same chat string because you just piggyback stuff on top of the unreliable stuff until it brute force arrives, which is interesting. But the whole point is you sort of get away with the need for having TCP/IP in there. You just have UDP and you do all the stuff you need to do anyway on an application level to be resilient to packet loss and out of order stuff. And even more interesting was like the blatant ideas that, oh, the server just sends an MTU of the entire server state to the client. It's like, here's the state, here's the state, here's the state. And so there's it's not an event based or a message based, you know, very verbose protocol. It's just like, here's everything. And obviously you say, well, that's impossible because you can't put, you're limited in what kinds of games you can do, because if your MTU is like 1500 bytes, you can't just put everything in there. And, you know, again, read up on it. Quake 3 does sort of advanced delta compression to get around that. But regardless, the whole idea of having just UDP and also having a simple protocol where the client says one thing and the server says one thing and that's it, right? That was really different from what I had done earlier with the ground control games, and of course, in the interest of having things be super duper efficient and, you know, making games on a super small budget, all of those sort of simple and small solutions were always of interest. So definitely for the peer version of the peer-to-peer version of Space Beast, it was really that sort of thing. It's like the client has one kind of packet, and all of the cheats of, not true, the cheat about doing chat in that way, it's done differently. But basically all the real-time stuff is the client has one packet which is upstream, which is some key flags, it's your WASDs, and it's your mouse buttons, and it's your view angles, that's it. And that's easy to get into an MTU because the client, it's not, the interaction fidelity isn't huge in a game like Space Beast. And of course, the client-server problem that Quake 3 had, I do not have in Space Beast, because the only thing that's happening is that everyone is sending their inputs to each other, and there's really no server, so it's a star topology where everyone is sending their stuff to everyone else, right? And all of the ideas of, oh, here are my inputs for a given tick, and the clients will send that to everybody else, like speculatively, here are my first whatever I've buffered, you know, here's like tick 0 to tick 4, and can I please have from you tick 0, because I don't have that yet, right? That's what one client says to another. And when you get an incoming packet, you say, okay, thank you very much, I got your stuff for tick 0 to tick 4. And if I redundantly received it, then I won't overwrite it, because it's important that the peers are authoritative about what they do, right? So you just say, okay, thank you very much for all your inputs, and I'm going to store those to be able to do simulation. And since you asked me for 0, then okay, I'll send you 0 onward, right? And so it's really, really simple protocol that way, and it's just fantastic that it can work at all. But of course, it's latency. It's very latency. It's not latency tolerant. So moving forward from that, it's like, what could I do to make it work, make it latency tolerant, and not radically change the architecture? I didn't want to change anything outside of the networking layer and see if I could basically get away with it and make it work. So again, back to the idea of the problem is the stalling. The problem is the game needs to simulate now in order to sustain a 60 FPS frame rate and simulation rate. It's like, okay, I know that I can always simulate correctly what I'm doing, because I'm the one who's deciding. The peers are authoritative about their own stuff. So it's like, I know what I'm going to do. That sort of means that you get a single player sort of experience without any lag or stuttering for your own self, because you're the one who's deciding where you're looking, what you're doing, and you're running the simulation locally. So the naive thing is just, okay, man, just don't block. Just run the simulation. Run the simulation locally. And just go. And it's like, okay, but what inputs do I use for the other players? If they're late and I don't have, say I'm on tick 67, I can generate the input for myself, but I don't have tick 67 inputs from essentially anyone. If you have high latency, you're just not going to have them. So the idea is, what would happen? And this is all on, you know, philosophical at this point. I haven't implemented anything. It's like, what would happen if I just went ahead and simulated? And just said, okay, I'm going to obviously put in the input for the local player because I know that's right. But for everyone else, I'll just assume that they did what they did last time. It's like, I'll use the last received input from them. And that's really what happens in first-person shooters in the client-server space, because that way the server can keep going. It's like, I'm going to use the last thing that you sent to me, and that's just, you just have to accept that, because that's how it's all going to work. It's, I just buffer the last thing that I got from each client, and I'll use that, and that's what they're doing officially until they tell me otherwise, right? So that works the same way. But the problem is, of course, since there's no state replication and there's no node that is the server that's saying this is the official stuff that's happening, what's automatically going to happen is you're going to diverge, because everyone is going to be doing simulation of a given tick in a different way, because different people will have different pieces of the whole puzzle, right? So you get a smooth game situation. It's never going to stall. It's just going to be like single player. It's going to be awesome, but it's going to diverge. So obviously you break everything and it's not going to work. It's not multiplayer. It's not a shared simulation anymore. But then I started thinking, that's going to solve the stalling, but it's going to break the game, so it doesn't count, it's not good. But it was still interesting. because then you start thinking about what does it mean to take the simulation? It means it's a sort of small mutation to the game, because running at 60 hertz, it's like the game doesn't change that much, right, from one tick to the next. So I started thinking about, like, what would happen if you isolated everything in the game simulation that potentially could change for any given tick. And that led to the idea of, like, there are obviously things in any sort of, if you think about it as the server, or the invisible logical part of the game, which is the actual logic that has nothing to do with, like, explosions or graphics or anything like that, because, you know, coming from a client-server background, I'd always put up a very logical barrier between this is visualization stuff and this is simulation stuff, or pure logic, and that was, you know, a core aspect of all of this. Is something that I guess could be talked about at great length, the whole idea of going with, like, a sort of model view controller idea where the visualization is separate from the actual simulation. So I had this concept, or a library in the game called Model, which contained the simulation. And so it was actually very easy to see, okay, here is the simulation, it's separate from anything else, it's very easy to reason about. It's a small piece of the code, which is, this is what is being mutated by a tick. But even further beyond that, I started realizing that, okay, there are parts of the model, I guess you could call it, the game model, which are static, or immutable, I guess you could call it. They're immutable for the whole duration of the game. And things that are fall into that category, things like the collision for the walls and the path map and like the location of data cores, and there's so many things in there that this is not going to change. And these are things that can be effectively moved out of the concept of a mutable simulation. So I went about, in the pursuit of all of this, I did a big split. It's like, what in the simulation is in the model? What is immutable and what is not? And my nomenclature was bad there, so I called it static and mutable, but it should be immutable and mutable. But in any case, I did that split, and then you start seeing that, wow, there's a lot of state there, because there are a lot of space beasts and a lot of moving parts. But it's conceptually very clear, like the heroes move around, and the astro creeps move around, and the space beasts move around, the doors open and close, the data cores go from active to inactive, a lot of things like that. But the thing that was in the back of my mind that some of you may be already realizing is that, how much state is that? And can that state be, like, really effectively isolated and packaged in a way so you can reason about exactly what changes? Because, again, the premise here is we're going to be doing speculative simulation of the game in a divergent way, but maybe it might be possible to do fix up on that later. So what I ended up, and this is really the theme of the talk here, is why did I go to procedural programming? Why did I give up on object orientation? It was because of this, because I was looking at all of this stuff and the structure of the code, and realizing to be able to boil this down to exactly what changes for a tick, I was thinking I need to look at the data separate from all of the other infrastructure. And when you're doing object-oriented programming, you're always like, here's an object, here's a class, it has methods and it has state. But I really started feeling I want to just isolate the state. And I knew, of course, that you can do procedural programming, so you can have like a struct of structs, which is just state, and then you can have functions outside of that which operate on them, which is supposedly ugly and public and not encapsulated and everything. But I was thinking, maybe that's interesting. So what I did is I did a big refactoring, partially to make the static stuff or the immutable stuff its own stuff, and that stuff wasn't necessarily moved to procedural style. But then I took all the mutable stuff and I pulled out all the data and made that into like a blob. It's like, here's the mutable state for the entire simulation, and everything was refactored to just be procedural functions operating on that stuff, and got that to run, and everything's exactly the same, and all there's no change in functionality, there's no regression, there's nothing like that, so it still works. all the networking still works. But it's interesting because you see, you start seeing this state is just this thing. It's like it's a buffer of memory. And when one of the things that I had to do there was make hard decisions about, okay, this needs to be of a certain size. I guess the size itself isn't important, but it needs to be of a fixed size. I didn't want to have any dynamic memory allocation in there. I didn't want to have any growing arrays, any buffers, anything that was structurally complex. So I made decisions about, like, okay, how many space beasts maximum? How many astrocreeps maximum? How many bullets maximum? How many data cores maximum? All of that stuff. I just made hard limits on all of that stuff. And of course, I did lots of tests to see, like, what are reasonable numbers. But then I just made a decision. It's like, okay, the size of the mutable state is fixed, always. And then you start getting into a situation where, look at this, there's a big struct, which you could basically see as a big blob of bytes, which has like the size of maybe it's like 40 kilobytes or something. And that's the mutable state. And that is what changes when you do a tick. It became very obvious, so clear to look at it. It's like you run the method called tick. What do you put into that? You put in like a pointer to your mutable state, and you put in constant references to, like, here's the input for this tick. And then you grind the gears like one step. It's like, I think about it like sort of like a self-playing piano. You start looking at what a game simulation actually is, and it's like, there's no magic there. It's just, you run this code and mutate this blob of data one step. Because again, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, I'm going to be diverging if I allow all the pairs to just go. But I'm sort of thinking this evil thought, what happens if I can do backups, right? So I'm thinking, when I'm running the network simulation and I'm ready to run, for example, tick 60, I'm looking at it, okay, I have perhaps, I always have my own inputs for my local player, I have maybe for one other player, but I don't have for the other ones. Okay, fine, then I'll say, this is not an official tick. I'm going to diverge from the official simulation. Fine, I'll do that. And that's really what I'm basing all the visualization off of, is this potentially dirty, potentially divergent version of the mutable state of the simulation. But what I also recall is when I'm going to do maybe tick 61 or some other tick in the future, perhaps it could be the case, potentially, that I do have all of the inputs for the tick that I want to go, which was, you know, sort of the earlier land case. Then I can say, okay, this is an official tick. I will mutate the simulation, and then I'll back that up. I'll back that, the result of that up as saying, tick 61 officially completed because I had all the correct inputs. And you see where this is going. It's like, obviously from the beginning, you're going to be doing a lot of speculation, but then at some time later, you're going to get across the network all of the ticks that you should have applied. And then you end up in a situation, oh, okay, then I can regress back to the last official simulation, which might be nothing, or the initial state, you know, just overwrite my mutable state with that, apply the correct tick, and then back that up, or apply the correct inputs, and back that up as the last official state, right? So, and then what you need to do to get back to where you were is you need to re-simulate based on that official state back to where you had predicted to. So it becomes this really conceptually weird thing where you're doing some speculative simulation, and then when you get real stuff, you turn back time, you do some real work, and then you fast forward time back to where you were. Because that was really what I ended up with as the what is the sync point? Like, how does anybody know what the current time is? Like, where should we be? And that's what I piggybacked on the inputs from the clients. Everybody says, I have speculatively predicted to tick maybe 100. And everyone runs to predict up to whoever is first. And that is the sync point, which is, for me, I mean, I can't motivate this in any way, shape, or form, theoretically. It's just, it seemed to be the right thing to do. And that's, in general, how I work. I try stuff in code. And I'm not good at that sort of, you know, sort of super logical analysis. It's more of a gut feeling thing. So this is basically what I implemented. And what I realized, obviously, is that, okay, all of a sudden, you're potentially doing many, many ticks of of the simulation. You're either doing official simulation or you're doing resimulation or whatever, speculative prediction. But you get into a situation where that has to be really fast, because instead of doing one tick every simulation step, like one tick every 60 milliseconds, you might be doing lots of them. And this sort of depends on variations in latency and who's slow and all of that stuff, because it's still peer-to-peer. We're still limited by the person who is the slowest and is the furthest behind. And that person is also going to be doing lots of resimulation to run to catch up to the other players who are, you know, the furthest ahead. So obviously, you need to optimize stuff. You need to look at this simulation code has to be so fast that you can afford to do it, because this game is still single threaded and it's still, you know, it's running at 60 hertz. You need to be able to do this stuff without running over that budget, because then otherwise you start dropping frames and then you start affecting the whole networking thing even more adversely, because you're being the slow person, right? So it's horrible that way. It's like, why would you even try to do that? But it was like still isolated. The idea was still isolated from the rest of the code base. It's still an external thing where you're just going in and you're fixing up the state in some magical fashion of the simulation, and nothing else in the code base notices this, right? So initially the performance wasn't there. So it was partially refactoring to like fixed size, mutable state, a lot of procedural stuff, a lot of, you know, cleaning things up and making them seem really simple. And again, to be really clear, the idea was, I was just assuming that having to back up, I needed to be able to say official state equals simulated state, like an assignment operator. I needed to copy a whole block of memory in a single atomic mem copy. So that was the idea. I didn't want to be doing deep copies of object graphs and dynamic allocation and all that stuff. I just needed to be able to copy byte buffers back and forth to be able to do the official state backup and to do the all of that stuff, because there's official state and there's the divergent, dirty, speculative state. So there's two versions of the mutable state, which are ping-ponging back and forth. So I really wanted the copy to be fast and simple, and that's really where the procedural idea came from, where here's the struct of data and it's a fixed size and all of that. So that was the one part of it, but then also I had to write basically a super low-level CPU clock timing utility to look at exactly what is expensive in the simulation. And I really did a super vigilant job of optimizing the crap out of everything. And some parts of the code, I guess, there are lookup structures, there are a lot of magic things going on to be able to avoid linear searches and you know, just in general, super low level performance stuff, which the game obviously, across the board, it really helps the game in general, because it means it's a better game. It's more optimized. You can put more stuff in, and it's good to have the overhead, right? I'm sorry. It's good to have the headroom, is what I mean. So eventually that was all done, and it seemed to work, right? And it seemed to work locally. And again, it was a horrible situation, because the earlier version worked for us. It always worked on LaLanne, and it always worked across the country. So it's like, how are we testing this? It's terrible. It's just, you're doing speculative stuff. It seems like it should work, but I hadn't sat down and worked out the whole implication of like, what is this actually logically doing? And it's hard to visualize, like, what is the rate of ping-ponging between doing official simulation and resimulation and back and forth, all that kind of stuff. NetGraph stuff, I did some visualization of it, but it wasn't really helping us. So it was like, oh my god, this is completely speculative, but it seems to work, and it's all working on our, you know, on our end. And I knew also one of the things was that all of the original input latency that Pier 1 had, the four ticks, which I noticed locally, like single player and networked games, they had a slight difference in feel to them. One of the good things about this new system, which is Pier 2, is the latency is effectively gone for the local player, because you're just running, you're speculating, you're always speculating and just going. So that's cool. It seems like that was really the core thing that motivated all of this. If you're getting rid of all the local latency, and there technically cannot be any local perceived latency, then that might actually allow us to get away with all the other crazy stuff, right? So we put it out there, and it was super scary. It was basically the gist of the feedback from everyone was like, thanks, now we can roll. It was like, thank you very much, you fixed it. And I was, and then it just continued to work. And that was, you know, just horrifying in a way. It was like, oh, it was wonderful that it did seem to work. But again, there was no validation that it actually did not diverge, or there was no like checking or hashing or any sort of feedback loop in the protocol that says, oh, this is actually working. And sure, you got some reports where people were like, oh, I had a situation where people were bouncing around, I was lagging and everything broke and everything. And of course, that seemed to be logical, that that you're probably going to end up in a situation where when somebody is really behind, then everyone is doing so much bouncing back and forth, doing re-simulation and all that stuff, that eventually there's going to be a tipping point where it just explodes. And that is, to this day, that is still hasn't been, you know, explored fully. But in general, it seemed like this crazy idea allowed it to be more latency tolerant and gave a reasonable experience to people who are playing the game internationally. And it was like the first time somebody said, oh yeah, we tried it between Texas and New Zealand and sure, it worked. Good job, you know. And it's like, okay, on to the next thing, because there's never been enough time in this project to actually follow things up properly, or, you know, dedicate people to just make sure that this is really solid. It's on to the next feature or whatever. But I guess it's a really happy story, because it was one of those situations where my intuitive sense of what might be possible sorted itself out by typing stuff and trying stuff out, and just, you know, in a sense being really fearful of the implications of all of this, but just, you know, sort of slowly moving forward step by step, and it sort of worked out. Apparently this kind of stuff is called eventual consistency, and it seems to be a hot research topic and a really hard problem. So I guess I can pat myself on the back by sort of having solved it and being in that space at all. It makes it interesting. But aside from all of that craziness and all the good stuff when it comes to, oh, Space Beast Terrified is networked in a way which makes it more robust, is that that was really the beginning of my official break away from object-oriented style to procedural style. Because in the aftermath of that, I the only thing that I had changed in the code base was a subset of the model, a subset of the simulation that was now in a procedural style with functions and structs. And I really, really liked the way that code looked. In a lot of ways, that code, it became smaller and cleaner, and it was just, it seemed minimalistic. Because the only thing that was there was the data that was required, really cooked down, and just the functions. And I saw that a lot of, you know, things that you typically have as private member functions in classes, those prototypes, I mean, or the function prototypes, they moved away from the header files into the CPP files. And what happens is that private member functions from a class become file local static functions. So you sort of start realizing from a dependency standpoint that, wow, this is much slicker, because the front, the public facing interfaces of anything you do, like here's a struct with some methods, that's only the minimal, that's actually the only public stuff. Because that's always been a thing with, if you look at a C++ header of a class, you might have a very small public interface to a class, but then you have the private, and then you have tons of stuff, a lot of methods, and all of the state is there. If you think about it from a compiler standpoint, it's like if you change something in the header, which is private, anybody who's depends on that header publicly is still going to have to recompile. And that is a thing that changes when you do a procedural style stuff, because things that are private to, implementation-wise, private methods to a module, they are actually private. And this really has nothing to do with encapsulation of state, of data, because obviously if you have a struct and you have a free function that is operating on that, everything has to be public. So everything is obviously public here. So it has nothing to do with that. But I sort of got the feeling that, wow, these this is actually slicker. This is actually more minimalistic. You don't have to do a lot of, you know, function prototyping. There's less boilerplate. And that style, for those reasons, is just sort of infecting the rest of my code base. And I mean, since my code base is really old and there's about a million lines of codes in it, it's not to this date really the case that everything has become procedural. But it is really the case that when I touch some system, I will try to change it to structs and functions. So from I want to change it from object-oriented classes to structs and functions. Just, you know, because that is really my feeling, that seems to be simpler, it seems to be more efficient, it seems to be more effective and less noisy, right? There are cases, of course, where I do polymorphism, like interface style polymorphism, like the Java interface idea or the C# or modern language interface idea, where it's really just a virtual function table. And that's interesting, because then you realize, yes, I want this to be an abstract interface to functions, and I don't want to see the state. I really mean it, as Rich Hickey would say. I want to abstract something away, and I don't want to see any state, and I don't want the base class to have any state. So it's like a pure virtual, in C++, it would be like an interface, a pure virtual thing. That stuff is still syntactically, I suppose, nicer to do inheritance-wise, because otherwise you'd have a struct of functions, which is the C style. And that they are, you know, they're technically equivalent, but it's still a little bit messier to do that sort of thing. And honestly, I'm probably bad at the syntax. So there are cases where I still do inheritance, right? But I'm really, really, really liking a lot of the feeling of the fact that there's no more this pointer. And I think for me that took a long time to get used to, but when you look at it, if you just do a straight port of something, you're going to end up having in all the methods that were previously member functions, you're going to have an extra parameter, which you can't call it this, but you could call it self or something like that, or instance or something, and you pass that along at the front or at the end or whatever, and it's usually writable if it's not a const method, right? Because if you think about it, it's like anything that's a normal mutable method, you pass a reference or a pointer to an instance of what was previously the class or the object, right? The instance of the class, the object. You pass a struct which is self, right? And then if you had something that was a const function, your free function obviously isn't const, but the reference is const or the pointer is const. So you can still do const stuff. But my point is that it was interesting to see. It's sort of like, oh, the self or the this, it can sort of get lost among all the other arguments to the function. And then you're feeling like, well, what's special about that? What's special about that argument? What's special about the self? Because I think when you're doing object-oriented programming, you're thinking that the object itself is sort of it's the first class citizen, and it sort of stems from the idea that that's what encapsulation is about. It's like this object operates on its own data, its own private data, and that's I'm the only guy who gets to touch my private parts, right? Or your friends. But now when it's all public, you're realizing that this is just an algorithm that's operating on some state. And you really get that feeling of, here's the state, and over here are methods that operate on that state. And then when you start using that style for a long time, you start realizing, where does this only member functions idea come from? I guess it's a divide and conquer thing. It really is a divide and conquer thing. That the whole idea, one of the philosophical ideas behind object orientation is the divide. You divide all of the massive amount of state you need in your program into little boxes, and then you associate the operations on that state into classes, right? And that becomes the higher level construct in itself. That's where managers come from and systems and all of that stuff. You have to ask the guy who owns the thing to play with the stuff, right? Whereas in procedural, there's state and you're messing with it. And it's a shared responsibility thing. But the whole point of my refactoring was I need to isolate all of the state to be able to do operations on the state en masse, right? It's like I need to back up all of the state. But then when you're updating like a space beast, then it only goes and touches a little part of it, right? But what happens, my point is, what happens is a lot of functions start moving around. And it's no longer the case where you're feeling like, oh, for every concept, for like a space beast, I need the header file and the CPP file, which you would do in an object-oriented style, really. And in Java, it's like, that's sort of like the, that's the rule, one class per file or whatever. But in procedural style, all that stuff just explodes. And I really feel that there's no real reason to say that one concept per file, it's just a module, it's just a translation unit, that stuff becomes very arbitrary. And then when you look at it that way, you start thinking, okay, here's a function that calculates something based on the state of a space beast. But then you start looking at, so where is this function called? Oh, it's called from some part of the visualization. Okay, and not from anywhere else. And then you're realizing, so why is this the responsibility of the space beast, which is part of the logical simulation? Why does the space beast have a method or a function in that code that does something that only the visualization cares about? Then you're realizing this is a data transformation, or this is some sort of algorithm on the data that has nothing to do with the simulation. And then you start realizing, oh, that's sort of a caveat of the whole. The space beast state is the space beast state. So if you want to ask the space beast something about its state, then you have to ask the space beast. Instead of, oh, I'm a visualization guy and I can look at the space beast myself and do something based on the state, and the space beast doesn't have to know, right? And I guess that's, some people are going to scream because that's, oh, then everyone is touching your private parts. But again, it becomes philosophically interesting because all of a sudden state is just state. And transformations on state or calculations based on state, they become very, very separatable, and they become very minimalistic and very sort of, in general, I just feel that the code base is much tighter and much more cohesive and much more straightforward and to the point with less code total, right? So it's very interesting how things just sort of in some ways got mushy. There are no really strict boundaries between, like, where does the code go? Where are the functions? That really doesn't matter in a procedural style, I'm finding. Whereas what happens is, in order to deal with all of the, you know, the public access to everything and having everything accessible, you know, conceptually to everything. I'm not talking about global state, but it's still all public. It's that you really start thinking about what state you have. And that really is, I think, is the big win. Because I guess if object orientation is about protecting yourself from messing around with all of the state you have in an uncontrollable way, that seems like the big win. That seems like the whole point of it. But what I've found is that when you're doing divide and conquer object orientation, you end up having so much state that you don't even know about. It's like you're once removed from the actual state and you're sort of playing like there was no state. Whereas in the procedural style, you're very, very, very aware of what the state is and what the minimal state could be in order to do any certain thing. And I guess the whole peer two thing was all about minimizing state and making everything super, super tight. But I'm really finding that, I mean, I've known this since early on. It's like all of the problems that you're going to have in a game or in a program are based on things that relate to state. I mean, there are trends in functional programming and you know, item potency and all that kind of stuff. Those pure functions are good because they don't have any side effects and your bug isn't there, basically. That's the thing. But if you have a lot of state, and especially if you have a lot of caches and a lot of duplication of state, that's where the complexity of programming really, really is. So if this style forces you to be more vigilant because everything is publicly accessible, again, not global, it's publicly accessible once you have a reference to something or a pointer, it makes you vigilant and it makes you minimalistic and it makes you write tighter stuff. And to be clear about the globality of things, because people would say, oh, procedural style gives you global access to a lot of mutable state. That in itself is not the case. It's not true. You can still use a style like I'm doing, which is the all of the access to things passes through the call graph. So you can still say, oh, okay, you need to, which is a good style because you don't have global access, you don't have singletons, you don't have, you know, stuff like that. But for any function to operate, you have to actually pass all the stuff into it that needs, you know, for to do its job. And that becomes super clear. And I would argue that that becomes even clearer than object-oriented systems, because in object-oriented systems, a big point of it is to hide the state. And that's what makes it hard to learn and hard to reason about people's architectures, because, like, why, where is this coming from, and where is the state coming from, and how does all this fit together? In a procedural style, when you don't have a global state, you end up having to pass everything everywhere. And that, I would say, is a huge self-documenting feature. And it just is simpler. And I really, really feel that there's so many problems, architectural problems, and problems of, oh, I don't have the state that I need, and I can't get access to it. All those things that we did to ourselves in object-oriented programming, those problems just simply do not exist. They just went away when I switched, and the more I switched to procedural. So I'm really finding a resurgence in my joy of programming. And I love that it's all so minimal. I love that I snicker to myself and look at this, it's public and it's a struct and it's not a class. And all of that stuff is just invigorating. And oh, by the way, I went through my code base and removed everything that was called class and switched to struct, which was great because I always recall in earlier days of programming, it's like every time I'm going to make something new, a struct or a class, there was always this sort of deliberation between, is it a struct or is it a class? And that's time spent. And I just went through and said, everything's a struct. And it just saves me time. It's like, it's all structs. It's structs and functions. And if it has member functions in C++ compilers, you can say, oh, it's a struct, but it has a member function if you want to do interfaces. So it's all structs. So it's just, I don't know, it's interesting to find. And of course, again, the big caveat here, I'm working by myself, right? I'm working by myself, and there's no huge number of programmers who are sharing the code base. And are there, I guess the question is, are there real gains to encapsulation and information hiding and all that stuff that's coming from OOP? I'm not so sure that the procedural and the publicness and all of that, I'm not certain that that is a problem for a big team. But again, I can't tell because this is me running my own shop. But I'm finding a lot of gains here, and I mean, the reasons for switching were not dogmatic or really philosophical, they were pragmatic. But now I'm starting to see things, you know, in hindsight, that are coming out of it. And one of the things is really, I've talked to colleagues and friends about this, but one of the things is sort of like semantics. It's like, does data in itself have implicit semantics? And when we do object-oriented stuff, it very much so does, because here's a class and it's called a tank or an agent or whatever, and it has member variables, and they're named in such ways, like here's a floating point value which is a time, and here's an integer which is a health. It's obviously semantically loaded, because otherwise we wouldn't call the variables those things, and we wouldn't call the class the things that we do. But that seems to be, you know, fundamentally a human construct. It's not essentially true in computer science that these floating point values or these integers actually have this semantic meaning. It's something that we do ourselves in order to express what we want to do in programming. But once you get over that and you realize that, yeah, I'm playing as if they have semantic meaning, it doesn't mean that they have semantic meaning. And how is that relevant? I mean, it's relevant when it comes to things like getting rid of constructors and destructors, which seems maybe not so intuitive. But for example, in my codebase, I have something called a blob, and that's just a struct that has an uint 8 pointer, or maybe it's a void pointer, and it has a uint 32 size. So basically, it's a self-describing memory block. It's like, okay, it's dynamically allocated memory Not necessarily. That's the thing. Again, semantic meaning. It's a pointer to memory, and it's a size that says, oh, this pointer, it points to something that has this size. And if that blob, if you did it with constructors or destructors, one way to think about that blob would be, oh, it is dynamically allocated memory. So you make a constructor that, maybe this is bad style, but you make a constructor that says, oh, I want this much memory, and the constructor allocates the memory and puts it on, assigns it to the pointer and fixes up the size so you know, and then the destructor will clear that stuff up for you. So it's a sort of resource acquisition idea. And that's cool, because then you can have sort of, oh, I want to dynamically allocate something, and then it'll clean itself up when it goes out of scope. But I'm using these blobs for things like compression. When I want to take some arbitrary structure and throw it, you know, run it through zlib or something, I want to compress it. So I'm finding, I could, in all those functions, I could say, oh, I want to compress some arbitrary thing. The interfaces could be, oh, here's the void pointer to the whatever data, and here's the size of it as a separate argument. But I'm sort of seeing uses for, like, yeah, but if I just pass, here's the thing you want to compress, and here's the output buffer to the method, then you can express that as, oh, here are two blobs, here's the in and here's the out. You compress the in to the out, but there are no implied semantics of, is the thing you're compressing from dynamically allocated, is the thing you're compressing to dynamically allocated? And when you start messing around with it like that, you realize that having constructors and destructors on this blob thing is just messing with you, because it forces you to use this blob in a certain way. It implies a bunch of contracts, and I guess maybe some people will say that's a good thing, but it doesn't really make things clear in any fundamental way. It makes the struct less reusable. So I'm seeing uses of blob where, oh, I'm going to use this blob as dynamically allocated memory. I'm going to allocate something, I'm going to do something with it, and then I have to clean it up. It's like, yeah, you lost the constructor did that for you. But then again, if you look at the code, it's more clear that what's happening. And I started realizing that a lot of the things I didn't like about object-oriented was things being implicit and magical. And where's the state? Oh, you don't have to care. It's hidden, right? All of the hiding. And constructors and destructors mess with me because they run implicitly. It's like, oh, you create something. If it has a constructor, it runs. So it's an implicit function call. And destruction is the same thing, right? And I mean, I'm not really into resource acquisition, is initialization and that sort of automatic stuff. And once you start getting rid of all of that stuff, it really has helped me, because I ran into a lot of bugs when it came to the peer 2 port. Which had to do with like wiping memory and things. I don't like using memset, but I really like the new C++ features of doing bracket initialization. So you say this structure is initialized with brackets and it'll wipe it to zero. I think that's a good style. But when you have structures of structures, and then somewhere in there there's a constructor on one of the structures that are in your aggregate structure, what happens if you use the bracket initialization is it doesn't do it. It doesn't wipe it. And I had so many bugs when it comes to uninitialized memory because there was something down there that had a constructor. So that was just one of the aspects of C++ where I just said, okay, screw it. I'm going to get rid of constructors in those cases that I can. And that has also been one of those liberating ideas, because all of a sudden data is just data. And it has no real semantic meaning. It's just data. It's semantic, you know, to the extent where, oh, this float is time and this float is hit points or whatever. Yeah, and you're saying, okay, fine, I'm gonna go with that and say it's time and it's hit points, and it helps you code, right? Because otherwise, you could just call your variables A, B, C, and that's hard, right? So it doesn't change it for the compiler or for the computer, but for you, it's hard. But I mean, my point is, only force yourself to deal with as much semantic meaning as you minimally need to, because it makes things more flexible. I mean, this is hard to appreciate, I think, for people who haven't done this, gone through this journey, but I find it to be really important, and I'm still learning. I'm still going through this transformation away from object-oriented programming. But I think that my productivity is much higher. I mean, that's the part of it that's sort of, you know, the philosophical, oh, you're doing procedural programming instead. But I mean, the fact that I really feel like I couldn't have done Peer 2 without this style, I mean, from a technical standpoint, without, you know, isolating state into one blob, you know, getting rid of some of the features like growing arrays and object graphs and polymorphism, all those things that I felt that I couldn't have. I really don't feel like I lost anything. I think I really gained a lot of insight into what programming minimally needs to be in order to function, and gained productivity, and really didn't lose anything when it comes to the quality of the product, and having fun and feeling like a maverick. Because of course, feeling like I'm going back to C, I've gone to snake case. Everything's lowercase. All my structs are like dude underscore T, because I saw that in id software code, and for some reason I find it interesting. I find it like a good style. So no more camel case. It's all lowercase, and even my constants and enumerations are all lowercase these days. I'm not sure about defines because it might mess things up, but basically I'm going to what I call nether snake style, and I mean that has nothing to do with this. It's like you can still do whatever code standard you want, but I'm finding a lot of utility coming out of being super minimal, and I guess that extends to caps versus, you know, camel case, or lowercase versus camel case, that sort of thing. But that's really, you know, a very long-winded sort of talk about how my experience is saying that perhaps object-oriented stuff in the scope of game development really didn't add anything, you know, critical or substantial. I mean, for me, I really felt that looking at it this way, it's like I wasted a lot of time trying to be high level, trying to be abstract, trying to write beautiful code from a sort of computer science-y sort of human level, and you know, focusing on the fact that the job is at the end of the day you're translating ideas and emotional concepts and graphical concepts and everything. You're basically translating it into what the computer needs to deal with, because that is your job. And I mean, you can try to avoid thinking about it that way and try to think about high level constructs and everything, but you still need to implement it, and you still need to live in the byte world, and you still need to live in the dynamic memory allocation world, and you need to, you know, think about endianness. You have to think about word sizes. You have to think about all that stuff. So I'm finding that, you know, the blanket statement is I don't believe in object orientation anymore. And I mean, the more inflammatory statement is I think that it has damaged the industry, and definitely personally damaged, you know, it made me waste some time, and it resulted in crazy architectures, because really programming is not about the high level stuff, it's about the low level stuff, especially game development. And these days I find I'm doing better games and better artifacts. I mean, the stuff that's coming out of my programming is better stuff. Partly because I changed the operative procedures. I changed the construct. I changed from object oriented to procedural, and the artifact that's coming out, and this is Rich Hickey's way of putting it, I changed the construct and I got a better artifact. So that's really the existence proof for me. It's like, oh, you changed the way you code and you made a better game. That's always going to win for me.